after page of drug ads for Latuda and Abilify and other antipsychotics to the Ask the Doctor column, which covered the many medications I had to choose from. My mother asked to read it because she wanted to learn how to better support me. I let her. When she finished and handed me the magazine, her face was clouded with concern.
"Are you sure you want to read that?"
I said, "Of course," and asked why.
"It's just so dark."
The internet offered so much information, so much contradictory information, about the natural remedies I could add. Folic acid and vitamin B12 were crucial to sound mental health. No, magnesium was. A high-fat, low-carb diet caused depression. No, a low-fat, high-carb diet did. Green and black teas were high in the amino acid L-theanine, which relieved stress and anxiety, but caffeine triggered manic episodes. The Mediterranean diet was the key to relieving depression, but particularly in smokers. Blogs on the Harvard Health website reported that there was overwhelming evidence for a connection between food and mental health, though others insisted further studies were urgently required to elucidate whether a true causal association exists. I scrolled down the Medical News Today website, past an ad for Vraylar, an antipsychotic as yet unknown to me, to be told once again that bipolar might be caused by a chemical imbalance that may or may not be helped by fish oil and vitamin C. Website after website confirmed that my prognosis was grave. With the diagnosis, my life expectancy had shortened by 9 to 20 years. The illness would worsen over time, each manic or depressive occurrence increasing that likelihood. With each depressive episode, my risk of having dementia rose. There was a very good chance I'd never have a long-term relationship or hold a regular job. I'd relapse. I'd end my own life. The inevitable was coming. Early death, more frequent episodes, relapses, suicide. I admitted to myself that I was, in fact, living, not staying, with my mother. I registered with a disability at one of the universities where I worked. My diet was impeccable, my sleep regular, when I wasn't in an episode, and my schedule precise. I rarely went out at night, or during the day, except to teach, walk, and run. I wrote my novel. I read. I watched Netflix. I prepped classes. I taught. I lost count of the number of times Dr. M told me how ill I was. The premise of our work together was that I was very, very sick. Occasionally, he agreed, with person-first consideration, that I was someone with a mental illness, not mentally ill. I was, as the cliche goes, more than my illness. It's not as if I could have questioned my diagnosis. Not admitting I was bipolar indicated a lack of insight, anosognosia, which meant I was in denial, which meant I was sicker than I thought. 4 months later, Dr. M said it was time to stop the SSRI. "Really?" I asked. He said that antidepressants could induce mania in bipolar patients, and long-term use could spur more episodes and potentially cause something called rapid cycling, a pattern of moving more quickly between periods of depression and mania. I thought of how I'd stood at my kitchen counter 5 years earlier with the SSRI, that orange oblong pill between my fingers. How nimbly I'd swallowed it. Within minutes, seconds, my mind had stilled and I'd entered a sea of calm. Innocuous, palatable, a simple adjustment. "It's helped," I said. He shook his head. "It won't for long." The literature, a term he used often to assert his authority, agreed he was right. Later, I'd learned that the literature didn't fully support his conclusion. Until 2002, antidepressants were used as the first line of treatment in bipolar disorder, and although some of the older antidepressants seemed to trigger manic episodes, similar evidence with modern antidepressants like SSRIs was lacking. According to studies, the risk of my illness worsening as a result of the SSRI was 12%. The likelihood of improvement was 41%. If I'd known that becoming bipolar would mean going off my SSRI and that going off my SSRI would lead to 8 months of severe withdrawal symptoms, I might never have let that oblong orange pill slide down my throat. Dr. B didn't mention that if after 5 years I tried to go off it, it wouldn't be a simple adjustment. Nothing like taking off a pair of glasses. In some ways, it wasn't Dr. B's fault. Not really. If a certain 1996 symposium had never taken place, I might never have ended up in those emergency rooms and partial hospitalization programs. In Phoenix, Arizona, 7 psychiatrists, Alan Schatzberg, Eric Kaplan, Peter Haddad, Michel Lejoyeux, Alan Young, Gerald Rosenbaum, and John Zayeka, gathered at the behest and expense of Eli Lilly, maker of the SSRI Prozac, before releasing a report that denied SSRIs can have withdrawal symptoms as severe as some narcotics. Pharmaceutical companies had been aware of people suffering symptoms like mine: brain zaps, involuntary muscle twitching, paranoia, nightmares, crying spells, for almost 30 years, and still pretended it wasn't true. In a report and editorials and papers published after the symposium, they named it SSRI discontinuation syndrome because SSRIs weren't associated with dependence and took too long to work. They insisted SSRI discontinuation syndrome, some called it SRI discontinuation syndrome, serotonin reuptake inhibitor without selective, was generally mild and transient and self-limiting, based on no clinical data. Symptoms were merely troublesome and could lead to missed work days. Nothing more. Without Eli Lilly and those 7 key opinion leaders, as pharmaceutical companies call doctors whose research they fund, Dr. B might have known to warn me that going off my SSRI, my supposed happy pill, which never made me smiley face happy but did slow my racing thoughts, would lead to 8 months of anxiety and paranoia, akathisia and confusion, sweating and agitation, insomnia and nightmares, and crying spells and seeing things and people who weren't there. And brain shivers, which made me feel like a waterfall of needles was cascading down the back of my head. And brain shudders, which felt like my mind was trembling. And brain zaps, which made me feel like I was being electrocuted. 2 months into my withdrawal, 2 months of tapering, each subtraction of a milligram of my SSRI, another zap or shiver or bout of confusion, I sat beside my mother on her blue couch. Staring down at my feet, I traced the pattern of her oriental rug so as not to look at my shaking hands. She sat beside me, her brow furrowed again. I tried to explain what was happening with the withdrawal, but telling her about the brain shivers and brain zaps and seeing things that weren't there would have upset her too much. So I told her about the trembling and sweating and crying spells and rushes of panic. She said I should call Dr. M. Even I could hear the panic in my voice as I left him a message. We waited. My mother rubbed my back the way she had when I was a child. In time to the arcs drawn by the movement of her fingers, I traced the curves in the design of her blue carpet. Dr. M called back at 10 minutes to the hour. He must have listened to my message right after his previous patient left. My brain feels foggy, I said after I'd told him a short, sanitized version of what was happening. His voice was concerned, steady. As he spoke, reassuring, planning what to do next, I told myself I'd be fine. Everything would be fine. Trust is more of a transaction than an emotion. There are two parties, the truster and the trustee. The transaction will take place in the future. By placing herself in the trustee's hands and at his whims, the truster has no power. When the word came into English in the Middle Ages, it had more to do with religious faith than relying on someone with power and having that trust honored. But it wasn't long before it became tied up in the honesty of the person trusted. The psychologist Erik Erikson said trust is the first stage of psychosocial development, lasting from birth until around 18 months. If children learn they can trust their caregiver, they'll be able to form trusting relationships and secure attachments throughout their life. If they learn they can't, they're more likely to go through life with anxious attachment, insecurity, and fear. As adults, trust prevents us from getting stuck in analysis paralysis. It allows us to move forward and pass the boundaries set by our rational minds. One could argue trust is delusional. It's privileging a delusion, the trustee's reliability and honesty, which may or may not be there, over reality, the inability to know for sure. 4 months into my withdrawal, I sat in my windowless office at the university where I taught, trying to prep for class. It was a Tuesday. It was April. The papers on my desk seemed far away, though they were right in front of me. My pen was pressed to one of them. I forgot what I was going to write, something about the text we were reading, something about... An electric zap shot through my brain. I closed my eyes and leaned forward, resting my head in my hands. It was startling, the power of the zap, how it reverberated. My instinct was to push through the zaps and shudders and shivers. As I reached for my notes for class, my hand shook. I stood, unsteady, more than unsteady, like I didn't have legs. They were disconnected as if they didn't belong to my body or to me. I left my office, having to return twice when I realized that I'd forgotten my water bottle and my copy of the text. With my bag slumped over my shoulder, I made my way through the sea of students in the hallway. It was a sea, my body a buoy bobbing among them. Midway down the hall, I strengthened. Being in motion helped. My legs woke. Except I wasn't convinced I was real. The bag on my shoulder might have been on someone else's shoulder. Me, but not me. My shoulder, but not my shoulder. The students who'd arrived early sat in their now familiar seats. Most stared down at their cell phones. A few tapped their screens. Others scrolled and scrolled. At the front of the room, I stood behind the podium and logged onto the computer. On screen, the homepage of the course website quivered as if there were about to be an outage. I looked away. Two students whooshed in the door, talking animatedly. Their voices were loud and tinny. They sat in the back row, still talking. One said something about a parking violation or an accident. Their voices faded in and out. I wrote the date on the whiteboard. The glare of the fluorescent lights was too bright. I stopped writing and looked down at the speckled brown carpeting. The thought of canceling class didn't cross my mind. It was something I didn't do, my professional standard. I took attendance and stood at the front of the room, not having finished what I was writing on the board. Half the date was up there, written in black marker, alone with nothing after it, as if the time we spent in class would never end and existed in a void. My legs became shaky again. I leaned on the podium to steady myself. We delved into a discussion about, ironically, a piece of long-form journalism by Gabriel Mack, nay, Mack McClelland, about the failure of the mental health system. My students liked talking about mental health, which they referred to as mental illness. Given how many of them had come to my office hours to share that they suffered from ADHD or anxiety or depression or were bipolar, I assumed that was why. They were a pathologized generation. Used to being told that distraction meant ADHD, sadness meant depression, and worry meant an anxiety disorder. Few were registered with the Center for Students with Disabilities. There could have been a million reasons for this, stigma being the big one, but it sometimes made me skeptical. They were so used to seeing mental illness portrayed dramatically and hyperbolically in YA novels and on TV shows and in movies. Why wouldn't they think everyone had it? Why wouldn't their adolescent minds tap into it as an explanation? But a part of me wanted to say, of course you have anxiety. You're in college. You're given quizzes and forced to take tests and are graded. That's anxiety-inducing. Other times, I believed every one of them had the mental illness they'd been diagnosed with. Did they already refer to their ADHD brains? Had they already been put on SSRIs to manage their anxiety or depression? How many of them had been told it would be a simple adjustment, just like wearing glasses? I asked about the author's use of form in the piece, how it moved in and out of personal experience and facts about the mental health system. One student, one of the boisterous ones in the back, informed us that that part was boring. I asked more questions. Some of the students picked up the thread of the discussion and sewed it among themselves. When that trailed off, I asked another question. One of the students, always attentive, started to answer. In my vision, she started to blur, or rather cloud over. It was as if I'd stood too quickly and the room was fading, except I was still leaning on the desk. I somehow got through the 90-minute class. Afterward, without stopping at my office, I went outside. It was a bright, early spring afternoon, unseasonably warm, enough not to wear a coat. I was shaking. I called Dr. M. He didn't answer. I left a message and paced. When he returned my call, I had already decided to take myself to the emergency room. Something was very wrong, I told him. He reminded me that I was coming off the SSRI. I told him about the worsening brain zaps and not being able to hear what my students were saying and the cloudiness. He reminded me that could happen when discontinuing an SSRI. We hung up. I wobbled and leaned on a small city tree to steady myself. Dragging my fingers along its rough bark, I told myself I'd be off the SSRI soon. Then I remembered Dr. M had said the last milligrams were the worst. When I started my SSRI, the chemical imbalance theory of mental illness had already been debunked. But, thanks to psychiatry's failure to be forthcoming, Big Pharma's stake in the theory, and the media's weakness for repeating false claims, it remained a publicly sanctioned cultural myth. The chemical imbalance theory says that mental illnesses like depression are supposedly caused by a deficit of neurotransmitters like norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. Many biological psychiatrists promise that one day, someday, even though it hasn't happened in 30 years of research, it will be proven true. Regardless, it wasn't true when I took that first orange oblong pill, and it isn't true today. There are an unknown number of neurotransmitters in the brain, and researchers don't know how they work. When it was first hypothesized by the psychiatrist Joseph Schildkraut in 1965, the chemical imbalance theory was little more than conjecture. Schildkraut himself doubted his idea that depression was caused by norepinephrine, not serotonin, which is how it's described today, but thought maybe it could be. It isn't. Yet the chemical imbalance theory hung around, perhaps because it's convenient to pharmaceutical companies and biological psychiatrists who want us to think that DSM diagnoses are biological. Their thinking goes something like this. DSM diagnoses haven't been shown to be caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, but pharmaceutical drugs affect neurotransmitters and are prescribed to treat DSM diagnoses, so DSM diagnoses must be caused by a chemical imbalance. As with Dr. B and his belief that I had ADHD because Ritalin seemed to be working, the drugs are said to prove not only the unproven diagnosis, but also its unproven cause. Even that isn't true. In 1998, psychotherapist and researcher Irving Kirsch published a meta-analysis, Listening to Prozac but Hearing Placebo, which found that antidepressants were only effective 25% of the time. Another 25% was due to non-specific factors, and 50% to the placebo effect. Kirsch wasn't actually interested in antidepressants. His research was on the placebo effect, how the hope or belief in an inactive pill can create the same healing effect as an active one. Kirsch was criticized for handpicking studies that would prove his point, but he did a second analysis that demonstrated the same results. He also wasn't alone. Other researchers conducted studies on antidepressants and the placebo effect that echoed Kirsch's findings. His follow-up book, The Emperor's New Drugs: Exploding the Antidepressant Myth, gave him 15 seconds of fame. Kirsch and his book were featured in Newsweek, and a segment about him aired on 60 Minutes. In a review published in the New York Review of Books, Marcia Angel, one-time editor of the influential New England Journal of Medicine, heaped praise on the book. But the repudiation of the chemical imbalance myth didn't catch on. And why would it have? In direct-to-consumer advertisements, drug companies like Eli Lilly and Pfizer advertised that SSRIs like Prozac and my very own Zoloft promised to raise serotonin levels and ease depression. The result was billions of dollars in revenue for Eli Lilly and Pfizer and others, and people who believed that if they received a DSM diagnosis and a prescription, they must have a chemical imbalance. The media played its part. As early as the 1970s, articles about it had appeared in the New York Times and Cosmopolitan. Even today, websites like Healthline cloud the facts by kind of telling people that the chemical imbalance theory is false, but then running headlines that declare it's what they'll be treated for. Ronald Pies, a clinical professor of psychiatry, defends psychiatry's role in proselytizing the chemical imbalance theory. He admits it's an urban myth and little more than an effect of psychiatry's high school crush on serotonin. But it's okay that it's an urban myth and it's not true, and we've been led to believe that it is. Pies says, yes, plenty of psychiatrists use the term chemical imbalance when handing a patient a DSM diagnosis. He then argues that no, psychiatry isn't to blame because, after all, some psychiatrists don't talk about the chemical imbalance theory. That's the problem. Mental health professionals don't say to their patients, oh, by the way, that whole chemical imbalance theory we talked about all those years and staked our reputations on and continued to let you believe isn't true. How likely would a patient be to adopt a diagnosis if a doctor said, well, you may have clinical depression, but we don't know what causes it, and it's certainly not caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, and in fact, we can't scientifically validate what depression actually is. But here, take this prescription for a drug that may work, though we don't really know how, and which may have terrible side effects and which you may have to continue taking because the withdrawal can be vicious? Some argue that, well, it's okay to make people think the chemical imbalance theory is true because it gives us an answer to the causes of our suffering that makes it easier for us to accept DSM diagnoses without seeing ourselves as flawed. And doesn't it reduce stigma? No, actually, it doesn't. One study showed that attaching a supposed biological cause to a diagnosis produces more shame, pessimism, negativity, and hopelessness about the future. Of course, the DSM never said outright that I or anyone else had or has a chemical imbalance, but it said my diagnosis might be biological. So what was I to think? Didn't Nancy Andreasen declare, these diseases, DSM diagnoses, are caused principally by biological factors? Didn't medical textbooks and others say the same? Didn't the DSM's 3, 3R4, 4TR, and 5 state in writing that their diagnoses might have a biological component? Wasn't a chemical imbalance in the brain biological? The DSM didn't make me swallow that orange oblong pill. Psychiatry's Bible actually offers no treatment suggestions at all. It just clusters symptoms and theorizes mental illnesses with which to label us and sends us on our way. One sign that something was very, very wrong was the absence of books on my nightstand. I could barely read, but forced myself to when I had to grade papers or comment on students' work. My eyes couldn't focus on the words on the page: sabotage, mine, our. The marks seemed random: commas strewed, apostrophes dangling, dashes dashed. It took a month, but I figured out that if I listened to the audio version of a book with the book in front of me, I could keep track. Following along helped still the words on the page, place them, order them beside and between the correct punctuation marks to gather meaning. Periods were the easiest to find. Those pronounced dots at the bottom of a line at the end of a sentence signal a contained thought. Going off the drug was going to kill me, period. Or an idea. I kept going because it would be better once I was off the drug, period. Or a declaration. It was their fault, period. It was his fault, period. It was my fault, period. The period orders. It comprehends. Aristophanes of Byzantium invented it. The ancient Romans ignored it. When the 7th century scholar Archbishop Isidore of Seville resurrected it, it maintained its shape and position at the top of the line. According to J.H. Chauvier's Treatise on Punctuation, it was monks who provided the period's next evolution. As scribes of the Christian church, monks had to write quickly. They figured out that the Romans' way of writing in all caps without spaces or marks wasn't perhaps the most efficient. First came the practice of cursive, Latin for running, in which letters were connected so the monks didn't have to lift their writing instruments from the page. They used a dot between each word and the periodus, a break indicated by 3 dots to show where one thought ended and another began. The dot between words was replaced by a simple space, and the periodus, which started to appear under the final word, eventually assumed its place at the bottom of the line and the end of a sentence. Archbishop Isidore and those monks returned clarity to us, understanding. They gave us back a sense of boundaries, limits, a place to say no more. But there was more. Like the night I was in the bath, the water so hot it turned my skin red, trying to sweat my withdrawal symptoms into the clear bathwater, hoping to watch them drain. They didn't. Not in the bath. Not while I put on pajamas and brushed my teeth and washed my face with soap, forgetting to rinse it with water. Not while I was in bed, listening to the pouring rain, desperate for sleep. Not when lightning flashed. Not when a thunderclap reverberated in my brain, shocking the resting withdrawal symptoms to life. Not when my brain felt as though it were undoing itself, coming apart. 11. On suicidal ideation. At our next appointment, Dr. M cocked his head to the side and looked at me. On his desk behind him was his usual can of LaCroix naturally essenced sparkling water. He asked how I was doing. His voice sounded far away. It felt as if the big gray couch was starting to swallow me. I can't take it. He turned to the LaCroix can and edged his finger under the tab. I begged him to let me go back on the SSRI. He reminded me of the damage it would do long term to stay on it, a possible manic episode, rapid cycling. Something seemed wrong, not about what he was saying, but with the black file cabinet in the corner. Both drawers were open halfway. Papers stuck out of the file folders as if trying to escape. The shudders and shivers, my thoughts, the nightmares. They're too much.
Your body and mind are reacting, not being damaged, he said.
I thought again of the morning I first took the SSRI, standing at the kitchen counter, the pill bottle open in front of me, how a shaft of sunlight came through the window, how much I believed the SSRI would make me better. Now better was no longer in the equation. I needed the SSRI.
Please, let me go back on it.
He lifted the tab of the LaCroix can. The carbonation released with a hiss. Give it time.
The essence of grapefruit reached me, strong and acidic. Someone once told me that hope is deadly. It's expectation, the certainty that something will happen, mixed with desire, want. But nothing in life is certain, and our expectations are so rarely met, which means that hope is actually a kind of tormenting want, something akin to what the Greek mythological figure Tantalus experienced when he was condemned to be forever thirsty and hungry in Hades, the fruit on the branches of a nearby tree always out of reach. Still, we equate hope with strength. Its symbol is an anchor. Sometimes it's a butterfly. Occasionally, a dove. In positive psychology circles, hope exists on a spectrum. Real hope blends optimism into reality. False hope is the deluded belief in the impossible.
I had hope.
Not firm anchored hope. Not flitting butterfly hope. Not free as a dove hope. False hope. That one medication or treatment for my bipolar would be the answer. A month later, I sat on the swallowing gray couch in Dr. M's office. He clapped his hands almost enthusiastically. We were nearing the end of the SSRI titration. Soon, I'd be off it. The withdrawal symptoms had seemed to build, climax, and now scraped along. Gone were the hallucinations, paranoia, sweating, agitation, nightmares, the brain shivers and shudders and zaps. But not the anxiety, confusion, irritability, insomnia, or crying spells, which seemed minor in comparison. He strongly recommended I start on lithium, the gold standard for bipolar. I knew little about it, aside from the Nirvana song of the same name. Though Kurt Cobain said the song was about the power of religion, not the drug, to save a person from suicide. And Kay Redfield Jameson's unbridled praise of it, which bordered on evangelizing. I said I wanted to try other, more natural approaches first. He raised his eyebrows. Lithium's natural. This was true. It rests below hydrogen and above sodium on the periodic table. I just want to try a few more things first.
There wasn't much left to try. I'd heard of cognitive behavioral therapy, which was touted by some for its effectiveness in helping to treat many DSM diagnoses, including bipolar. The treatment primarily involves filling out worksheets. In doing so, the patient becomes able to manage her thoughts and establish healthier behaviors. CBT didn't come naturally. At the time, I believed that psychiatric medications were the best and most necessary treatment for my diagnosis. By then, I was on 3, the SSRI, which I still wasn't off, a benzodiazepine for the brain zaps and panic attacks caused by withdrawal, and the anticonvulsant mood stabilizer lamotrigine. Lithium, the miracle mood stabilizer, would make 4. I read books on CBT and did the worksheets. Lots and lots of worksheets. It was somewhat helpful. Feeling Good by David Burns, a Stanford psychiatrist who was a student of Aaron Beck, the father of CBT, was the most convincing of CBT's powers. Burns's books popularized CBT in the 1980s. The CBT workbooks made me aware of my black and white thinking, the way I overgeneralized and catastrophized, and how I jumped to conclusions, mentally filtered the negative in most situations, and thought I knew what other people were thinking. But it didn't lessen my symptoms or change how I was functioning. It did make me consider taking lithium. I thought CBT would be presented as the alternative to medication, but Burns wrote that bipolar disorder, my diagnosis, may require mood-stabilizing medications such as lithium. CBT also made me believe even more strongly in my bipolar diagnosis. Part of it was that CBT used the same labels: major depression, anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, which made them seem even more real. Everyone seemed to agree they were valid. But I was still wary of lithium. I agreed to try Tegretol, another anticonvulsant used as a mood stabilizer. It seemed fine at first. We started with a small dose. After 3 days, he upped it dramatically. It didn't seem right, but he was the expert. I stood at the counter in the morning and at night, 3 mornings and nights in a row, and swallowed the shockingly large beige pill. It made me so ill I couldn't move. I emailed to tell Dr. M. Later, when he called, his voice was taut and angry. He said we'd discuss it at our next session. Standing at his office door to greet me, he looked annoyed. I entered, feeling as though I'd done something terribly wrong. He sat at his desk. The LaCroix can stood by the phone. Still weak, I lowered myself onto the gray couch. He said the pills weren't making me sick. Even if they were, I shouldn't have made my email sound like it was an emergency. I should give the medication a chance. To do what? I asked. He turned away and opened the LaCroix. To work. We spoke of finding my next medication as if it were urgent. Certainly, an episode was imminent. Depressive or manic, who knew for sure, it was weeks, maybe days away. If I wanted to prevent it, I'd listen to him and take lithium. I asked again about the side effects. He said my thyroid would probably stop working, but I didn't need it anyway. There'd be weight gain, maybe acne. Toxicity was an issue, but not a big one. "We'll check your lithium levels," Dr. M said. I must have looked worried because he followed this with an impatient, "It's fine," as if to say, stop making such a big deal out of it. It all made sense. Very sick people need very powerful drugs. I was very sick. I had to treat my bipolar. Okay, I'll take it. He raised his eyebrows. His mouth twitched, then curved into a smile. This, he said, was a breakthrough in my recovery. Lithium's history is storied. In the early 19th century, it was thought of as a tonic prescribed to remedy gout and rheumatism, and by the end of the century, literally flowed like water. Companies advertised lithia water and boasted of its lithium content, billing it as a remedy for nearly everything. It was a key ingredient in 7-Up, yes, the soft drink, promoted as a way to have energy, enthusiasm, and avoid a hangover. But when it was marketed as a salt substitute, it earned an FDA warning after it was said to have contributed to the deaths of multiple people. Because of the risk of toxicity, the FDA didn't approve it as a bipolar medication until 1974. The World Health Organization included it on its list of essential medicines. In academic journals, it was alternately cast as a miracle drug, a placebo, or a poison. I had my blood drawn and my levels monitored at a diagnostic lab across the street from Dr. M's office. Over the months, it became routine. I'd check in with the bored receptionist behind the counter, sit in the waiting area, and half watch Ellen or some other daytime talk show on the TV mounted on the wall. The threat of toxicity was real. I could end up in a coma with brain damage or dead. Possible side effects included tremors, increased urination, thirst, diarrhea, vomiting, weakness, blurred vision, ringing in the ears, thyroid dysfunction, and kidney failure. During one appointment, after my name was called, I followed the lab technician to the back room and sat in the chair. She tourniqueted the plastic tubing around my bicep. I looked away as the needle pricked my skin, clocking the seconds until it was over, and the nurse pressed the gauze to my skin and told me to keep pressure on it. I later walked down Wabash under the L train. The lightheadedness came on fast, followed by a wave of nausea and the certainty that I was going to throw up. I went to the curb, rested my hand on the hood of a car, leaned over, and dry heaved. And again. The nausea and dry heaving didn't go away. Not for 2 months. 2 months, all day long, with barely a moment of relief. 2 months of being so nauseated I gagged and dry heaved and sometimes had trouble walking a block. 2 months of eating mostly saltines and yogurt and ginger. Even teaching became strenuous. Any woman who's been pregnant would have glanced at me sidelong. Yeah, I'll tell you about nausea. But in pregnancy, at least, nausea is a rite of passage in the gestation process that leads to a new life, the miracle of their own progeny. This led nowhere. I asked Dr. M if the lithium might be causing it. He said it wasn't. My nausea would pass. It didn't. I made an appointment with a gastroenterologist. Waiting in the examination room, I filled out a brief form. At the bottom was a series of boxes to check, with each symptom filed under a category: circulatory, muscular, allergy, digestive, and psychiatric. After one firm knock on the door, the doctor entered. She was young, mid-30s. Her blonde hair was tousled in a ponytail. Her pug nose made her seem disagreeable, but her warmth was genuine, signaled by the skin around her eyes that creased when she smiled. We went through my symptoms. She listened, asked questions, and took notes. After an examination, she speculated three causes for my complaints: anxiety, cyclical vomiting, or psychiatric medication interactions. I asked if lithium could be the cause. No, she said, but it might be the anticonvulsant. The lamotrigine? I've been on it for years. A new medication can trigger different side effects in an old medication. So it is the lithium. In a sense, she said, but we can't be sure that's what it is. When I told Dr. M it might be the lithium after all, he said, matter-of-factly, that it wasn't. I asked if it might be. He insisted it wasn't. She said it might be. It will pass. Of course, I considered stopping the lithium without telling Dr. M. If I had, I'd have joined the many patients with serious mental illnesses who exhibit non-compliant behavior, NCB, by not taking their medications as prescribed. Some researchers prefer the term non-adherence because non-compliance makes it sound as if the patient has no agency. It's common. One review found that NCB rates among people being treated for chronic conditions could be as high as 77%. NCB contributes to higher rates of relapse, hospitalizations, emergency room visits, substance abuse, work absences, and suicidal behavior. It also contributes to higher healthcare costs. NCB is a passive act of resistance, which isn't to say it isn't damaging. It's a betrayal of the physician-patient relationship. And it's dangerous. It can sometimes look like carelessness, or irresponsibility, or willfulness, or hopelessness. But I kept taking the lithium, swallowing the white pill, partly because I'm a rule follower. Someone reading this has probably already diagnosed me with perfectionism. And partly because I'd finally stopped taking the SSRI and hoped I was finally on the right medications. So I took the lithium. I took it, even though it was making me ill. That summer, while my mother was out of town, I went for my usual walk along the lake. It felt like I was in a dream. The world around me seemed gauzy, the way the pages of my books had in high school. Gauzier. The beachgoers' voices were muffled. Their laughter seemed to crackle. The waves seemed to froth as they crested. A thought came. I could just end it. Then, pills. Water. Then the image of me in the water, and all of it gone. I don't know how long I stood there before I thought of my mother. I couldn't do that to her. She'd blame herself. I told Dr. M. It seemed like the right thing to do. He was my psychiatrist, the man keeping me from breaking down. I couldn't hide anything from him. He upgraded my diagnosis to bipolar 1 and said that because I'd been suicidal and had a plan, it was necessary for me to be in a partial hospitalization program, PHP. What's that? I asked. Of the 4 levels of care, inpatient, the hospital, residential, PHP, and intensive outpatient, IOP, PHP was like being in the hospital without having to spend the night. I'd also have to stop seeing him, this was protocol, and rely on the therapists and psychiatrists in the PHP. He asked if I thought he was abandoning me. I said I did. He said he wasn't. I was ill and needed help. As a clinician, Dr. M wasn't supposed to be able to predict if I'd attempt to end my life, only to recognize if my risk for suicide had increased. Often that comes down to whether a patient has a plan. But researchers have found that passive suicidal ideation, no plan, can, in some cases, be as clear an indicator of risk for suicide as active suicidal ideation. Ideator status, passive versus active, can change during a depressive episode. Having a desire for death and a plan to end one's life indicates similar risk rates for suicide. Having both is, of course, the riskiest of all. Dr. M's conclusions as to my risk for suicide likely would have been influenced by the 1979 suicidal ideation scale developed by Aaron Beck and Maria Kovacs. On the scale, he would have given my desire, seriousness, deception, and the availability of my chosen method a score between 0 and 2. My predisposition to suicide would be factored in. I probably would have come out at 2. Marital status, unmarried women are at a higher risk than married ones, 2. Triggering events, a 2, history of relationship instability, chronic worrier, perfectionist. Symptomatic presentation, 2, I was bipolar and agitated. Presence of hopelessness, 2. Frequency of suicidal thinking, 2, often intense and for long periods. Previous suicidal behavior, 1, never actually tried. Impulsivity, 1, and protective factors that might prevent me, 0. My reasons for living were few beyond writing and feeling an outsized need to be there for my students and teach my next class. But he never disclosed how he assessed my condition. And I, foolishly, never asked. On my first day in the PHP, I arrived 5 minutes early. The reception area was oppressively air-conditioned. I wasn't teaching that summer and had the time and insurance to pay the $1,000-a-day fee. As soon as I entered, I wanted to leave. The director of the program welcomed me. She was young and nice without being saccharine. As we walked to her office, goosebumps prickled my skin. More goosebumps, more cold rooms. My mind twisted with thoughts of how sick I was. I had to be. I was there. After the intake, the director showed me to the kitchen and the refrigerator available to patients. I was a patient. When she dropped me at my assigned group room, she asked if I needed anything. I wanted to say yes, to leave. Instead, I sat in one of the chairs that had been formed into a circle. As other patients arrived, I eyed the door. The more people there, the easier it would be to slip out. A woman about my age with dark curly hair entered, then a young man who might have been one of my students, then a woman who looked to be in her 20s with a pixie cut. No one spoke. Most sat and pulled out binders. A whiteboard covered either wall. A classroom. I could be a student. No problem. The 2 facilitators arrived, a young guy and a youngish woman, both of whom walked with the confident air of the well-adjusted. The woman gave me a binder filled with handout after handout of CBT worksheets. In the back were some on dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT. Originally designed for people with borderline personality disorder, BPD, DBT teaches patients how to live in the moment and regulate their emotions. The facilitators took turns lecturing us on how to treat thoughts as if they weren't necessarily true. I can't do this, and I'm not good enough, and it's their fault, were just propositions put forth by the mind. I took thorough notes. During lunch, I organized my binder for easy reference. We were later assigned homework. That night, I went home and shared with my mother what I'd learned. She looked as hopeful as I felt. The next day, I saw the in-house psychiatrist, Dr. V. He was beyond caring. His dark, enthusiastic eyes were those of a man who genuinely wanted to serve every patient as best he could. I had my final meeting with Dr. M that afternoon. He said he'd spoken to Dr. V. "And?" I asked. "What did he say?" Dr. M smiled. He said, "Wow, she's really bipolar." The PHP was remarkably undramatic. 20 or so patients filled the room each morning. In the afternoons, we were divided up into smaller groups of 4 or 5. Most of the patients were white, more women than men. They had the insurance or the monetary support to be there. Those I talked to were on paid leave from their jobs. 2 patients told me they were bipolar 1. They didn't say they had it, they said they were it. None of them had symptoms like mine. None was on the same medications. Yet we all supposedly had the same diagnosis. Art therapy was my least favorite part. For someone who prefers not to draw or be spoken to like a 6-year-old, each day having to sit around a table and paint my emotions or cut pictures out of magazines to create a vision of my perfect home was a little hell. My fellow patients seemed not to mind. Some had actually volunteered to be there to work on themselves. I sympathized with them. Many were clearly in pain. But every morning on my commute to the program and on my way home, I passed people living on the street, an estimated 25% of whom were most likely struggling with serious mental illness, and as many as 45% with mental health conditions. PHPs are another result of deinstitutionalization. For those with insurance and means, they're the community centers that never were, meant to shelter those who need more than a psychiatrist's and therapist's help, and to transition those who have been hospitalized or in residential care. All of it made me question who was getting help and who wasn't. The next time I saw Dr. V, he recommended an antipsychotic in addition to the lithium. An antipsychotic would help with my anxiety now that I was off the SSRI. It was often used to complement mood stabilizers like the ones I was on. It would bring my medications back up to 4. He said he'd consulted Dr. M, who'd agreed. The side effects were many: agitation, anxiety, constipation, dry mouth, insomnia, and massive weight gain, 30 to 100 pounds, which could lead to diabetes and high cholesterol, which could lead to other major health issues, which could lead to death. And nausea, which I was already battling. And tardive dyskinesia, jerky, involuntary movements like waving one's arms or jutting one's tongue out over and over, a side effect that wouldn't necessarily go away even after I stopped the drug. And akathisia, Dr. V said. "What's that?" "Extraordinarily rare," he said, his chin jutting slightly as if to emphasize the point. I asked what it was. "Basically, restlessness." Restlessness didn't seem that bad. So I filled the prescription and returned to my mother's apartment. Standing at the kitchen counter, I swallowed the pill. A beacon of hope. I didn't ask why I was prescribed an antipsychotic without ever having been psychotic. The derealization and depersonalization I'd experienced were considered dissociative, not psychotic, disorders. I didn't ask because Dr. V presented it as the professional standard. Nothing to worry about. The FDA had approved some psychotics to treat bipolar, but not Rexulti, the one I was given. It hadn't been approved to treat anxiety or insomnia either, but psychiatrists prescribed it for those too. The FDA approves drugs for specific illnesses, but allows physicians to prescribe them off-label for just about anything. Its reasoning is difficult to fathom, almost Alice in Wonderland-ish in its logic. The FDA website tells patients it's up to the physician's discretion. From the FDA perspective, once the FDA approves a drug, healthcare providers generally may prescribe the drug for an unapproved use when they judge that it is medically appropriate for their patient. Why then go through the hassle of approving a drug for a specific use in the first place? Without off-label prescribing, antipsychotics would have been limited to the small number of people who actually experienced psychosis. Antipsychotics are prescribed for depression, anxiety, ADHD, childhood conduct disorders, even insomnia. On the gray market, pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and others make billions from off-label prescriptions. Though it is prohibited by the FDA, some make claims in direct-to-consumer Ask Your Doctor campaigns that fail to tell viewers that the drugs they may take will be for an unapproved indication and unapproved age group in an unapproved dose and unapproved form of administration. The Mayo Clinic Proceedings Journal encourages off-label drug use. Patient advocacy groups, like the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which received $23 million from pharmaceutical companies between 2006 and 2008, the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, which the Los Angeles Times reported got half its funding from pharma, and Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, which reportedly received nearly a quarter of its funding from pharma, tell the public that taking off-label medications is safe and helpful. Helpful means of service or assistance. Without data, studies, or any basis for making such claims, what service and assistance could off-label prescribing provide? 3 nights later, I sat on my bed in my room, rocking back and forth. It had been that way for an hour or more. I sat, but not with any sense of leisure. I wanted out of my skin. Occasionally, I stood and paced. When I stopped pacing, I continued to move, shifting my weight from one foot to the other, or lifting one leg and the next over and over again, marching in place. When I sat, I crossed and uncrossed my legs. It was like someone else was inside me, moving me. I rocked. I stood again. I paced. I marched. I rocked. Then a violent agitation seized me, dark and aggressive. I called Dr. M., barely hearing the options for which number to press to leave a message. My hands shook. I spoke fast. To the wrong person, I might have sounded manic. After I left the message, I ran to the bathroom for a bout of diarrhea. I returned to my room and marched in place. When Dr. M returned my call, I explained again, talking very fast. As I did, I sat on the edge of the bed, tapping my foot, crossing and uncrossing my legs. "You may be having a reaction," he said, sounding concerned. "Akathisia." Turns out, akathisia isn't extraordinarily rare. It is, in fact, a common side effect of antipsychotic drugs. Estimates range from 10 to 45% of those who take such medications are affected. It's considered one of the most dangerous side effects because it can cause such anguish as to drive a person to suicide, which I took the pill to prevent. Dr. M and Dr. V lowered the dose and put me on a regimen of Benadryl. Eventually, the akathisia lessened. They recommended I try a different antipsychotic, Vraylar. I said yes out of the hope that it would work, though I no longer knew what that meant. The akathisia returned, just as brutal. They said they could only lower the dose, reminding me how sick I was and that I needed to stay on an antipsychotic. It seemed impossible and senseless. I didn't agree. But I didn't argue either. Hopeless is defined as having or feeling no hope, as if no hope were an emotion. To be hopeless is to despair. It's a state of desperation beyond want and need, a kind of void with no way out. In positive psychology, no hope means helplessness, lost hope, resignation. Though suicide can be an act of desperation, it also signals a loss of hope. Someone who's suicidal is left without the expectation of a future, without desire, and without the two in combination. To a person experiencing suicidal ideation, John Locke's statement about hope would feel like it was written in a foreign language. Hope is that pleasure in the mind, which everyone finds in himself, upon the thought of a probable future enjoyment of a thing which is apt to delight him. Everyone? Probable future? Delight? Alexander Pope's famous statement would be even more unintelligible. Hope springs eternal in the human breast. Eternal? My suicidality, being actively suicidal, was filled with the desire to live. Because if I only wanted to die, I wouldn't have been suicidal. I would have been dead. I was discharged from the PHP because I had to teach. The director didn't want me to go. I asked if everyone there was independently wealthy. She asked if I could file for short-term disability leave. No, neither of the universities where I taught offered disability leave to part-time professors, as if only full-time employees fell ill. My first night teaching after being in the PHP, my students sat at the tables shaped into a square, seminar style. I stood at the whiteboard with my back to them. The marker felt strange in my hand. My legs shook. It was like coming to work when you think you've recovered from the flu, a long flu, only to find you're still sick and regular life demands too much. I put the name of the course on the whiteboard, ENG 208, Writing and Reading Creative Nonfiction. The letters were in the correct order, made into words that made meaning we could all understand. Canceling the class and claiming illness wasn't an option. I could, of course, but with the shakiness and strangeness came a need to be with students, to be of use. I turned to them. Like so many of my creative writing classes, it was mostly made up of women. I smiled, and as I did, the smile became genuine. One student, Katie, was so eager to learn, I felt like I was learning from her. There's always at least one in a class, a student hungry not just for information or knowledge, but understanding, integrating the class into her very being. Her engagement wasn't grade-driven. She wasn't skimming the surface. Her hunger came from somewhere deep, a place few students find mainly because no one else has it to give, so it has to come from them. Soon, Katie and the others were all I thought about. The chair I sat on felt real, the pen in my hand, too. The sentences on the handouts I passed out made sense. The 3 hours sped by. But as they packed their things to leave, fear sank inside me. Katie stayed after class to talk more about the essay we'd read, an excerpt from Claudia Rankine's Citizen. We'd run out of time just as we started to discuss the section called Stop and Frisk, in which Rankine writes about racial profiling. Katie said something about the characters being forced into silence. I wanted to hear her, but her voice sounded so far away. I've never understood mental illness memoirists and bloggers who say they had a love affair with suicide. Suicidality is a vortex. It's deafening and silent, empty and full of horror, the darkest place I've ever touched. On the first autumn morning of the year, the weather app on my phone said 58 degrees. Outside my window, the wind blew. No, ripped through the trees. A motorcycle roared past my window. I imagined the man driving it dressed in yellow leather. My gym bag, with the pills in it, sat on my bed. People describe suicidality as linear. There's a reason, a plan. But it's not that orderly. Although the akathisia was gone, my thoughts had been spinning for 3 days. Sometimes they shouted. Sometimes they were viciously helpful, offering new suicidal thoughts, other methods, different timings, new locations. I left my mother's apartment and pushed through the front door of the building and onto the street. Blue sky, sun, pedestrians. Down the block came the little white dog I disliked and its owner, whom I'd never spoken to. The crackling grind of an iron balcony being soldered on the apartment building across the street made me hunch over. I saw Dr. M that afternoon. With the pills still in my bag, I sank onto the gray couch and started to cry. I wanted so much not to want to die. I mentioned the pills. Once it was out, I couldn't take it back. Second time, clear plan. He asked if I wanted him to call an ambulance, or if I could get to the hospital myself. The security guard at the emergency room took my belongings, cataloged them, and locked them up, pills inside. She was genuine, almost apologetic as she directed me to sit in a chair with the other SIs, those with suicidal ideation. Security guards watched us to make sure we didn't try to harm ourselves or leave. The SI next to me rubbed the stubble on his chin. His eyes were knowing, like he'd been there before. His flannel shirt was clean, his khaki pants dirty, his Timberlands untied. A nurse in dark blue scrubs came up and asked him questions. Are you suicidal? Have you taken anything? Have you cut yourself? Do you hear voices? Are you seeing things that aren't there? He answered, yes, no, no, hesitant yes, no. The nurse asked, are you homeless? Yes, he answered. She asked, do you have allergies? Yes, he said with authority. Haldol? It's pretty much impossible to be allergic to Haldol, an antipsychotic that's the stuff of nightmares. It's potent and can produce a zombie-like effect. That SI knew the drill and how to handle himself. The nurse told me to go into the bathroom to put on a gown. Then she led me to a triage area with a curtain that couldn't be drawn so the security guards could still watch me. Two new male SIs arrived, one in Velcro restraints because he'd been brought in by police. The other passed out on his gurney. After an hour and 15 minutes, I stared at the clock. A nurse came in. She looked so young, she could have been 13. She took my vitals. Then she struggled to get the vials of blood they needed. The doctor, she said, would be in soon to finish my medical check. Then, finally, a psychiatrist would see me about being admitted. The sound of a woman screaming incoherently came from down the hall. Her words were a jumble of gasps and curses and get your hands off me and someone's gotta help. The doctors in the station across from me discussed her loudly. They debated the options for treatment. The woman's screams turned to howls. One doctor said something about an injection. Another confirmed. Haldol and Ativan. The woman screamed. The doctors moved out of view. Within 10 minutes, all was quiet again. 4 hours later, I was still waiting to see a psychiatrist.